Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Friday, March 21st. I am Flagstaff volunteer reader Julia. Front page articles for today include City of Flagstaff mulls sale of vacant lot on Butler Avenue, Arizona executes Aaron Gunches 23 years after murder, and Matador Coffee and NAU Campus Dining partner to bring local brew to campus. The first article we will start with is City of Flagstaff mulls sale of vacant lot on Butler Avenue. The City of Flagstaff is preparing to sell an undeveloped parcel of city-owned land adjacent to Butler Avenue that has sat vacant since the 1990s. Today, I want to tell you a little story about a small parcel which has had an outsized impact on staff resources for the past couple decades. The city's real estate manager, Bryce Dottie, told City Council on Tuesday, March 11th. The lot at 116 East Butler Avenue was originally acquired in 1991 when the city was improving the roadway, Dottie explained. Following a 2024 City Council resolution requiring the city to consider development of affordable housing on any city-owned properties, city staff have explored multiple possibilities for building residential units on the parcel, including a collaboration with Habitat for Humanity, but without success. The biggest obstacle is that the lot sits within a special flood hazard area, defined as any part of a floodplain with a 1% chance or greater of flooding in a given year. Those areas are established by Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, flood risk maps. Under county law, any new residential construction must be elevated above FEMA's statistically calculated base flood elevation for the area, which, in this case, would mean building about 9 feet above ground level, significantly increasing the expense of any project. Once the Rio de Flag flood control project is completed, a joint effort of the city and the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA issues a revised set of flood maps for the area, the elevation requirement for the property should be reduced, Dottie said. But the timeline to complete both the construction and the remapping is uncertain. City manager Greg Clifton estimated offhand that it might be as long as 7 years before new flood maps are completed and issued. In the meantime, Dottie said, the property is functioning as a sort of informal parking lot. Unauthorized camping on the lot, abandoned vehicles, and trash have provoked complaints from nearby residents and businesses. He added, "We are probably not being the best neighbors by virtue of owning this property." He suggested three possible options to the council: sell the property, develop it as an official parking lot managed by Park Flag, or take no action for the time being and wait for the Rio de Flag flood control project to reach fruition. Turning the site into an established parking lot would require paving and other improvements, he noted, and those would likely cost more than any revenue generated from the parking. Staff has spent an enormous amount of time on this tiny parcel, and I think the payoff is diminishing the more time we spend on it, Dottie concluded. Council was generally receptive to the idea of selling the property if the proceeds from the sale could support more cost-effective, affordable housing projects elsewhere. Who knows when we'd really be able to build something meaningful, Councilwoman Lori Matthews said during the discussion, noting the uncertainty around the timeline for flood mitigation improvements. She supported auctioning off the property. She added, "Let's just get it sold and redirect our resources to things that are more important to our city." Councilwoman Kara House admitted that she felt some reluctance about putting the lot up for sale because it appeared to be a good location for infill development. "My main goal is to ensure this is not a lost opportunity for additional affordable or attainable housing stock, she said. I just want to do what we can to ensure that we're not losing a piece of property that could become more of the housing supply that we desperately need. Only Councilman David Spence expressed any enthusiasm for the possibility of converting the site to managed parking, and he clarified that he saw that only as an interim use until housing could be constructed on the parcel. Ultimately, the council gave Doty the go-ahead to proceed with an appraisal of the property ahead of soliciting bids for its purchase. In an email following the meeting, Doty said he anticipated the appraisal would be complete within 60 to 90 days, and he expected to open the invitation for bids through the online platform Planet Bids within 4 months. If staff receive a bid meeting or exceeding the property's appraised value, they will bring the bid to council, along with the city's attorney guidance on whether funds from the sale can be directed to affordable housing efforts for a final decision. And that was the article, City of Flagstaff Mulls Sale of Vacant Lot on Butler Avenue. The next article is Arizona Executes Aaron Gunches 23 Years After Murder. The Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry executed Aaron Brian Gunches on Wednesday. Gunches, a convicted murderer who had twice petitioned to hasten his own execution, was the first inmate executed in the state of Arizona since a series of botched lethal injections prompted a halt to the practice in 2022. In a press release, the department stated that Gunches' execution went according to plan and without incident. Gunches entered the execution chamber at 10:02 a.m., received pentobarbital through intravenous lines inserted into both arms at 10:14 a.m., and was pronounced dead at 10:33 a.m. Gunches was sentenced to death in 2008 for the 2002 murder of Ted Price. Following the execution, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays said, "The family of Ted Price has been waiting for justice for more than 2 decades. They deserve closure." Arizona has a troubled history of prolonged and painful executions. The hours-long death of inmate Joseph Wood in 2014, after he was injected with an experimental combination of drugs, led the state to pause executions until 2022. 3 additional death row inmates were executed in 2022, but ADCRR personnel struggled to properly place intravenous lines during those executions, prompting one of the men to exclaim, "Can you believe this?" Governor Katie Hobbs ordered a halt to executions and a review of the state's policies after taking office in 2023. But a year and a half later, Hobbs canceled the review and dismissed the retired judge conducting it, alleging that he had exceeded his mandate and responsibilities. That judge, David Duncan, has stated he intends to finish and release his report independently. Critics of the state's execution plans have argued that Arizona has not adequately remedied the failings of its lethal injection procedures and suggested that ADCRR's use of privately compounded pentobarbital for executions is unsafe, painful, and cruel, and potentially in violation of federal drug laws. And critics of Gunch's execution have drawn attention to the fact that Gunch's represented himself throughout all legal proceedings and consistently sought the death penalty for himself, which they say amounts to suicidality and should have been reason to reevaluate his mental competency. Following Gunch's death, 111 other inmates remain on death row in Arizona. At this time, no additional warrants for execution have been issued. And that was the article, Arizona executes Aaron Gunches after 23 years post-murder. The next article is Matador Coffee and NAU Campus Dining partner to bring local brew to campus. Seeking to continue developing a connection with the Flagstaff community, Northern Arizona University is collaborating with the Matador Coffee Roasting Company for its first locally owned food service brand on its campus. Three locations are now branded with the Matador name via the partnership with NAU Campus Dining, including Matador at Scholars Corner in Klein Library, Matador at Bean and Beaker in the Science Lab facility, and a third simply named Matador Coffee inside of University Union near the information desk. A grand opening event took place Monday, February 10th, with a ceremonial ribbon cutting at all three locations. According to William Brandt, NAU Campus Dining's brand and partnerships manager, discussions with Matador Coffee began about a year ago as conversations initially focused on serving beans in the existing cafe spaces. The plan quickly evolved into something much bigger, fully branded Matador Cafes on campus, offering the same great coffee and food found at their Flagstaff locations, Brandt said. Matador's commitment to quality and flexibility to fit campus culture made them the perfect match, and our collaboration brought this vision to life. Brandt called Matador Coffee an ideal partner, with the company standing out immediately due to its enthusiasm, commitment to quality, and collaborative spirit. Considering NAU launched its certificate in brewing and fermentation science with local microbrewers, Brandt said a local coffee house felt like a natural step as the university sought to continue building a bridge with the Flagstaff community. For Matador Coffee, once it's connected with NAU Campus Dining, the plan to open the three different campus locations just needed a few months of planning, followed by some construction work during the winter break. Opening up as the spring semester began, Matador Coffee owner Mario Martuscello said he was blown away by how well received the business was by students and faculty. With the Matador's coffee locations on Milton Road just steps away from NAU's campus, Martuscello explained how significant the partnership is to his business as well. "We do see a lot of students at our Milton shop, but nowhere near the numbers we can touch on campus," Martuscello said. "From a marketing standpoint, it's also a huge opportunity. Just being on campus, connecting our brands to the students and faculty will grow us in Flagstaff, but also carry us beyond campus. We have people from all over the country coming to NAU, so we're very happy to be part of their college experience." Though the bar menu of alcoholic drinks at Matador Coffee's Milton location obviously won't be appearing on the campus location, most of the business's signature drinks, burritos, and paninis will be available in order to keep all the menus as uniform as possible, according to Martuscello. Additionally, freshly roasted coffee by the pound will also be available by the pound, as well as Matador Coffee merchandise. Brandt said the branding was a key piece of the collaboration between NAU Campus Dining and Matador Coffee, with the cafes intended to feel authentic to the business's other locations while still honing the history of those cafes on campus. A few of the current items left off Matador's NAU menus could be added in the future, with the exception of the pastries offered, which will still be made by the Campus Dining Bakery team by the recipes and direction provided by their own chef. Matador's NAU locations will also have pricing that matches the menus of its off-campus locations, and student meal plans will include transfer specials similar to those at all of Campus Dining's other retail locations. From opening until 11 a.m., students will have the choice of steam or drip coffee, hot or iced, with a breakfast burrito. After 11 a.m., the special includes a variety of hot and cold beverage options with a variety of baked pastries. Campus dining will still operate the trio of Matador locations on campus, staffing the cafes with student workers and baristas who will prepare the beverages and food to the specifications of the Matador. And that was the article, Matador Coffee and NAU Campus Dining Partner to Bring Local Brew to Campus. The next article is legislation would crack down on mixed hoteling in Arizona. State lawmakers say hotel guests should know if the facility is also serving to shelter those who are homeless, and now they are on the verge of making that a law. Legislation approved Wednesday by the Senate Government Committee would preclude the use of public funds for what Representative Matt Gress calls mixed hoteling. That's when a hotel or motel accepts not just paying clients, but also those who need emergency, temporary, or transitional rooms to those who are homeless. But his HB 2803 also would require those hotels to erect a sign at least 2 feet high at all entrances with Gothic bold letters a third of an inch high in red ink, not just informing guests about homeless being housed there, complete with a recommendation that they keep hotel doors locked, safely store their belongings, and report any health or safety concerns to local law enforcement. And guests would also have to be personally informed of the presence of homeless when they check in, and given the opportunity to instead get a full refund and go somewhere else. The party line vote in the committee came over the objections of Jeanne Woodbury, who represents the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence. She said, "This is not just about shelter for those who are generally placed in the category of being homeless." HB 2803 unfairly targets hotels that provide emergency housing for victims of domestic violence and homelessness, Woodbury told lawmakers. "We feel it stigmatizes hotels that support these programs, making it less likely that businesses will participate in critical emergency housing efforts." Moreover, Caitlin Contreras of the American Civil Liberties Union of Arizona warned that the broad wording of what Gress wants would have even broader implications. "Consider," she said, "the case of those who are victims of natural disasters, like what happened earlier this year in California, where more than 5,400 homes were destroyed in the Eaton and Palisade fires, and more than 12,900 households displaced by the blaze." Contreras said any hotel taking in any of these people, who she said would be considered homeless under the bill, would have to post the same warning signs and live under other provisions of the measure. Gress told Capital Media Services that it is not his intent to deal with emergency situations like that, but he conceded that the legislation, which has already been approved by the House, may need to be amended when it now goes to the full Senate. But Contreras said that change still wouldn't solve legal problems with the measure. For example, she said the government can't force hotels to erect signs that interfere with their ability to conduct business and remain financially viable. That said, Contreras amounts to compelled speech by the government on private entities, something she said violates the First Amendment. Potentially more problematic from a constitutional perspective, Contreras said, is the bill would compel participating hotel owners to stigmatize homeless persons by implying that the government believes they are more likely to commit theft and have health issues. Gress said the issue came to his attention when he learned that Scottsdale, an area he represents, was using tax dollars to rent 10 rooms at a local hotel. He testified that he would understand such use in limited situations, like entire families who needed to stay together, or people with pets for short-term stays. Neither situation can be accommodated at homeless shelters. However, that, said Gress, isn't the case. Exhibit number one, he said, is the Windermere Hotel, which the city of Mesa uses as part of its off-the-streets program, as the facility rents some of its rooms to the city. You will see some of the most traumatized Yelp reviews or Google reviews you'll ever see from unsuspecting paying customers who checked into the Windermere and soon realized this was operating as a quasi-homeless shelter, Gress said. A check Wednesday of reviews found a more mixed selection. One on Expedia.com complained of a closed pool and lobby. Homeless loitering, filthy, unsafe. I can't believe you would list this property, it reads. While another on Yelp said this place isn't as bad as the reviews, but said that this part of town has homeless and yes, it's ghetto. Gress, in an interview with Capital Media Services, said nothing in his legislation bars hotel operators from renting their rooms to the homeless, as long as other guests are informed and as long as no public dollars are involved. He said the whole concept is of using hotels as homeless shelters is bad policy. They're not designed for that, he said. They're not staffed to do that. Then there's what Gress calls the consumer protection angle to his legislation. If there is a paying patron who is going to the hotel, I think that they should be made aware that the hotel they're going to is also being used as a quasi-homeless shelter, he said. Gress said there's a legitimate reason for requiring a hotel to disclosure that there are homeless people being housed there versus, say, mandating that guests be told up front that rooms are being occupied by college students on spring break. The homeless population is a very different and vulnerable population, especially when you're taking people off of the streets and putting them into hotel rooms, he said. A lot of people who are being taken off of the streets are suffering from severe mental illness and or addiction, Gress continued, and when you have families with small kids around, I think there's a safety issue. He said all that should be disclosed to guests up front who, armed with that information, could still choose to stay or that they could take their money and go find another place. And that was the article, Legislation Would Crack Down on Mixed Hoteling in Arizona. The next article is Flagstaff Beach Volleyball humbles Coconino in home opener, 5-0, to hold onto crosstown rivalry crown. Flagstaff dominated Coconino during its first home match of the season at Flagstaff Athletic Club, East, on Wednesday. The Eagles won in straight sets at all five pairs. Since starting the season, the Eagles have shut out every opponent 5-0. Coconino was also undefeated before the matchup. Panthers head coach Scott Dendy said his players were even more disappointed in their loss because it's the first of 2025. I think we've been doing really good so far at building a culture where we expect to win. So when that doesn't happen, obviously, we are disappointed. But they're a very good team, Dendy said. They were in the state championship last year and almost won it. All we are going to do is keep our heads up and build on the things our weaknesses exposed today. Dendy said he noticed all five pairs had different areas that needed improvement. For example, the number three pair of Marley Johnson and Naomi Gray started off strong in the first set against Flagstaff's Ava Collins and Peyton Killeen. They went on a 5-0 scoring run to tie the score 21-21, but Flagstaff earned two more points to win the set 23-21. This was the closest margin of victory the Eagles had all day. Dendy said he noticed defense was lacking with his threes and that it allowed Collins and Killeen to go on a 9-2 scoring run in the second set and earn the third win of the day for Flagstaff 21-10. At the beginning of the game, we were just off, Collins said. It always takes us a second to click in, but it was taking a little longer than usual, so we were getting a little worried. But once we started hitting our first few shots, we knew that we could do it and that we had it, and we just went on our run. Eagles head coach Beth Haglin said she noticed the girls were nervous and thought it was a mix of nerves due to the rivalry and jitters of the first home match of the year. "I thought the girls played really well," Haglin said. "I think the nerves got the best of them in the early stages of each match. But I felt like once they got going, they did their job. Our game plan was put into place." At the Fives court to start the day, Flagstaff sophomores Nadia Nez and Nola Henderson dominated over Coconino sophomores Lucy Whitting and Paisley Roden, 21-15 and 21-8. Nez, who was fresh from a state tournament title run with the girls' basketball team, played her first beach volleyball match of the season on Wednesday due to the basketball team's deep postseason push. Flagstaff's fours of Harley Mosang and Bryn Hagerman did not give up more than 13 points between both sets. They scored 21-7 in the first and 21-5 in the next. Coconino's fours of Ava Wilkie and Peyton Phillips could not keep up with the Mosang and Hagerman. At the twos court, Coconino's McKinley Lund and Laurel Gernahaus lost 21-17, 21-18, to Lillian Hartman and Gabriela Saucedo Salas. Flagstaff's top pairing of Sophie Krasner and Macy Mosang completed the sweep over Ava Gray and Lucy Stiegler, 21-12 and 21-6. Some of the girls from the Flagstaff and Coconino teams play club volleyball together during the offseason, and the rivalry match became more tense because of their close relationships. The girls know each other's strengths and weaknesses. "We love Coconino to death," Haglin said. "They're awesome. They're great girls. There's those expectations when you come in and just have fun with the people you really care about. But the hard part is that those emotions run high, and everyone wants to win. It's Coconino and Flag High. Of course we want to win." On Coconino's side, Naomi Gray plays with several of the Flagstaff girls on a club team and said it was harder to play against them because they know each other so well. "It puts a little extra pressure on us," she said. Flagstaff is scheduled to play at Dysart on March 26th for its second section match of the season. Coconino played Trivium Prep on Friday and will host Northwest Christian for its second section game. This was the only rivalry game between the schools all year. The only time that they would have a chance to face off again is during the state championships. And that was the article, Flagstaff Beach Volleyball Humbles Coconino in Home Opener 5-0 to hold on to Crosstown Rivalry Crown. You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also get our stream and on-demand programs with the new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. The next article is Flagstaff researchers continuing to study COVID 5 years after the start of the pandemic. COVID-19 first arrived in Coconino County on March 16, 2020, and local efforts to study the disease began not long after. That April, health professors and students at Northern Arizona University began work to forecast outbreaks in the area, using census data to predict the spots where it could spread and impact hospital systems in four counties. The Arizona COVID-19 Genomics Union also formed that month and began sequencing the virus to learn about specific strains. Other local studies looked at a cancer drug's potential effectiveness in treating COVID, analyzed the antibodies of patients who had recovered from the disease, and tested candidate vaccines. Those efforts all started in 2020, and research into COVID and its ongoing effects has continued in the years since. Research projects from a variety of fields are continuing to study the disease, from how people reacted to tracking the ways in which the disease spreads in both humans and animals. Tracking COVID in wildlife. The Translational Genomics Research Institute, TGen, is continuing to study COVID in 2025 through learning about the disease in its endemic state through efforts such as wastewater testing and as well as studying it in wildlife to understand how it has spread through the environment. TGen uses animal tests to track how it has spread through the environment since it arrived in Arizona. David Engelhalter, TGen North professor and director, who also leads Arizona State University's Health Observatory, described this as a One Health approach, looking at how the health of humans, animals, and the environment interacts to form a system that can affect all three. We saw this during the pandemic, that it was starting to infect animals in a very strange way, Engelhalter said. COVID moved from humans to animals and is now maintaining itself in nature at some low level. The version of COVID currently spreading among humans is relatively mild, he said. Studying the virus in animals is meant to understand how it may be shifting in a different setting. That's a risk for us, in that if it gets adapted to another animal species, it can pick up mutations that we wouldn't have already seen, or perhaps make a more infectious or more dangerous version of the virus, he said. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but the only way we know is by doing these kind of surveillance systems, where we're looking for it in animals, tracking it, and seeing how it's changing. Through collecting samples from wildlife rehabilitation centers across the country, the researchers found COVID in multiple animal species, including deer, bobcats, and squirrels. Another TGen study in this area is testing about 1,000 dogs across Arizona, including pets, dogs in shelters, and dogs with jobs. This is used to research where the virus is most likely to infect dogs and what a COVID infection looks like in the species. How we understand the pandemic. Researchers at NAU have been using medical anthropology to study people's reactions to COVID since almost the start of the pandemic. Lisa Hardy, a professor in the Department of Anthropology and director of NAU's Social Science Community Lab, said she began writing a research proposal, then collecting responses immediately. That work eventually grew into a collaboration between researchers in 9 countries. In anthropology, when we think about health, illness, bodies, contagion, humans make meaning from all of these things that tell us about who people are, how they see the world, what they think of when it comes to politics and economics, who they think is valuable, she said. The pandemic research isn't really just about the pandemic. It's about all of these other things that have to do with inequality, access, global relationships, and this bigger meaning. In the first days, it was really exploratory, she said. The researchers asked people about their perceptions of recent events, the way their lives were changing, and even, what is COVID? Part of the study also looked at how people's political affiliations related to their trust in the government, healthcare, and public health. For a later project, the researchers and a youth participatory action research class at NAU worked with Flagstaff Arts and Leadership Academy to interview youth about how COVID and the pandemic affected their mental health. Hardy said the interviews showed a range of responses to the pandemic. One published article from this work found that the far ends of the political spectrum on both sides believed someone was out to get us, though they attributed this to different actors. A soon-to-be-published article explored the impacts of the early days of the pandemic, when some were saying that only certain groups of people, the immunocompromised and elderly, would die from COVID. Some people, that put their mind at ease, While to other people, it felt really harmful and scary to think that they or their loved ones were not cared about or were disposable, she said. One thing Hardy said they learned through this project was that political divisions have grown. She said this wasn't necessarily a direct result of the pandemic. I don't think it was new by any means, she said. The pandemic brought things to the surface and made them very, very visible that maybe not everyone was thinking about before. She also said the research showed community care and connections through the relationships people built during the pandemic and efforts to care for one another. She recalled one young participant who discussed thinking through the various impacts of a library closing as an example. NAU researchers are still interviewing people for this in 2025, though the project has begun to wind down. The group is planning a similar study of perceptions of current politics in the United States. Further research. Here's a selection of Flagstaff's efforts to study COVID in the years since the start of the pandemic. A joint effort from TGen and NAU, published in January 2021, studied how immune systems respond to COVID. They compared antibody responses to COVID and other coronaviruses, finding that the response to COVID is affected by previous exposure to coronaviruses. In July 2022, a team of NAU researchers received an NIH grant to develop a platform meant to help public health officials assess different models to predict the spread of disease, similar to those used to track the pandemic. TGen began publishing a COVID-19 sequencing dashboard in April of 2021, meant to track the different variants of the virus, along with the University of Arizona, Arizona State University, the CDC, and Quest Diagnostics. That dashboard was updated through December 2024. And that was the article, Flagstaff Researchers Continuing to Study COVID 5 years after the start of the pandemic. The next article is Trump Signs Order Aimed at Dismantling Department of Education. Flanked by students and educators, U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday signed an executive order intended to dismantle the Federal Department of Education, making good on a long-standing campaign promise. The order leaves school policy almost entirely to states and local boards, a prospect that alarms liberal education advocates. The signing follows the department's announcement last week that it plans layoffs for nearly half of its staff. It is the latest step by Trump, who has been in office 2 months, to reshape the U.S. government and upend the federal bureaucracy. Education has been a political lightning rod in the United States, with conservatives favoring school choice policies that help private schools and left-leaning voters largely supporting programs and funding for public schools. Disputes about U.S. education accelerated during the coronavirus pandemic, a divide Trump tapped as a presidential candidate for his second term. Trump has said he wants Education Secretary Linda McMahon to put herself out of a job, but Congress would have to pass legislation to shutter the department, and Trump does not have the votes to do that. Although Republicans control both chambers of Congress, Democratic support would be required to achieve the needed 60 votes in the Senate for such a bill to pass. DOE oversees some 100,000 public and 34,000 private schools in the United States, although more than 85% of public school funding comes from state and local governments. It provides federal grants for schools and programs, including money to pay teachers of children with special needs, fund arts programs, and to replace outdated infrastructure. It also oversees the $1.6 trillion in student loans held by tens of millions who cannot afford to pay for university upfront. Prior to the signing, White House spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt told reporters that student loans and Pell Grants would continue to be overseen by a slimmed department. A few other critical functions of the department, including funding special education and civil rights enforcement, will remain intact, she said. She cited disappointing literacy levels and testing scores among U.S. children as justification for scaling back the department, which was founded in the 1970s. Court challenges ahead. Trump has acknowledged that he would need buy-in from lawmakers and teachers' unions to fulfill his campaign pledge of fully closing the department. He doesn't have it. See you in court, said Randy Weingarten, the head of American Federation of Teachers. United States Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat, said, Donald Trump knows perfectly well he can't abolish the Department of Education without Congress. But he understands that if you fire all the staff and smash it to pieces, you might get a similar devastating result. Trump also has delivered broadsides against higher education in the United States by reducing funding and taking on diversity, equity, and inclusion policies at colleges and universities, just as he has in the federal government. A majority of the U.S. public does not support closing the federal education department. A Reuters/Ipsos poll in February found that respondents opposed closing Department of Education 65% to 30%. The Reuters/Ipsos poll, which was conducted online and nationwide, surveyed 4,145 U.S. adults, and its results had a margin of error of about 2 percentage points. Federal aid accounts for 15% of all K-12 revenue in states that voted for Trump in the 2024 election, compared with 11% of revenue in states that voted for Democratic rival Kamala Harris, according to a Reuters analysis of Census Department data. And that was the article, Trump Signs Order Aimed at Dismantling Department of Education. The next article is Columbia Faces Deadline for Meeting Demands Over Campus Protests. A deadline looms for Columbia University to respond to 9 demands on tightening restrictions on campus protests that President Donald Trump's administration says are preconditions for opening talks on restoring $400 million in suspended federal funding. Among the unusual demands, the administration wants the New York University to ban face masks on campus and seek arrest powers for its security employees. It also demands that Columbia reform its student admissions policies and adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of antisemitism, which lists certain criticisms of Israel as examples of antisemitism. Trump's administration is also demanding that the university place its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies department under academic receivership for at least 5 years, taking control away from its faculty. A 2-page letter addressed to Dr. Katrina Armstrong, the school's interim president, and Columbia's trustees sent on March 13th, spelling out the conditions, did not explain why receivership was one of the demands. The administration extended a Thursday deadline for Columbia's response to the end of Friday, the Wall Street Journal reported. Spokespeople for Columbia and the 3 government agencies that sent the letter did not respond to questions on Thursday. The face-off between the private university and the White House is an extraordinary test of the extent of a president's executive powers. Columbia's response is being watched by other schools the administration has sanctioned as it advances its policy objectives in areas ranging from campus protests to transgender sports and diversity initiatives. Some professors and students have denounced the administration's actions as an assault on academic freedoms and the independence of higher education. Trump says he is trying to eliminate anti-American insanity, Marxism, and radical left sentiment from universities. Trump has singled out Columbia repeatedly since returning to the White House in January over the pro-Palestinian student protest movement that roiled its campus last year. The Ivy League university's lawns filled with tent encampments of noisy rallies against the U.S. government's support of Israel. Pro-Israel counter-protests were also frequent. Trump and some pro-Israel lawmakers in Congress say the pro-Palestinian protests intimidated Jewish students and staff and accuse Columbia of allowing anti-Semitic harassment. The university has defended itself by saying it has worked to balance freedom of expression without tolerating antisemitism or other prejudice. Protesters, including some Jewish students, say criticism of Israel is being wrongly conflated with antisemitism. American Association of University Professors, some Columbia faculty, and students and civil rights groups have accused Trump of authoritarianism and violating constitutional rights to free speech and due process. The subjugation of universities to state power is a hallmark of autocracy. Todd Wolfson, president of the American Association of University Professors, said in a statement. The Trump administration announced on March 7th that it was immediately canceling federal grants and contracts at Columbia without following the usual lengthy investigation and hearings process in the Civil Rights Act. The administration has declined to say which grants and contracts were targeted. The next day, federal immigration agents arrested Palestinian student activist Mahmoud Khalil, a prominent figure in last year's protests, saying the government had canceled his permanent residency green card because his presence was contrary to U.S. foreign policy interests. Khalil said in a statement from a Louisiana immigrant's jail this week that he is a political prisoner and he is fighting the government's efforts to deport him in court. University Senate. The administration did not say in its letter why it was targeting Columbia's Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department. However, some Republican lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives last year criticized at least two professors of Palestinian descent working in the department for their comments about the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Academic receivership is a rare step taken by a university's administrators to fix a dysfunctional department by appointing a professor or administrator outside the department to take over. It is unheard of for the U.S. government to demand such a step. Many of the administration's demands entail policy changes that would have to pass its university senate, made up of elected students, staff, alumni, and faculty. Columbia has shared governance with the senate since the late 1960s, when anti-war students organized disruptive protests in which they seized control of buildings and briefly held a dean hostage. The Senate has repeatedly criticized any signs that Columbia administration was sidestepping the body's governance powers, including in April when the administration, without Senate permission, called police on campus to arrest student protesters for the first time since 1968. The Senate declined to advance a proposed mask ban earlier this year. In New York, only a state or local government can grant powers to private citizens, such as Columbia security employees, as the administration demands. In a campus-wide message on Wednesday, Armstrong wrote that Columbia will not waver from our principles and the values of academic freedom and free expression that have guided this institution for the last 270 years. She described the various ways the school has combated harassment and prejudice on campus and promised a new webpage to report the school's progress. She did not address how the school would respond to specific demands. And that was the article, Columbia Faces Deadline for Meeting Demands Over Campus Protests. The next article is Agency Demands Urgent Safety Assessments of Iconic Bridges. National Transportation Safety Board on Thursday recommended urgent safety assessments of 68 bridges, including iconic bridges Golden Gate, Chesapeake Bay, Brooklyn, George Washington, and Chicago Skyway. NTSB Chairwoman Jennifer Homendy said the board wants bridge owners in 19 states to perform vulnerability assessments and determine the risk of catastrophic collapse from a vessel collision. NTSB is making the recommendation after the March 2024 collapse of the Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge after it was struck by a cargo ship, killing 6 people. If a bridge is determined to be at risk of collapse, measures to reduce risk need to be implemented, the NTSB said. Other bridges that need urgent reviews include the Bourne and Sagamore bridges across the Cape Cod Canal in Massachusetts, Richmond San Rafael Bridge, and Mateo Hayward Bridge in California, McKinnick Bridge in Michigan, the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in Florida, Memorial Bridge in New Hampshire, and the Verrazano Narrows, Manhattan Bridge, and Williamsburg Bridge in New York. And that was the article, Agency Demands Urgent Safety Assessments of Iconic Bridges. The next article is White House Considering Burgess to Lead CDC. The White House is considering former U.S. Representative Michael Burgess to run U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention after withdrawing the nomination of vaccine critic Dave Weldon last week, according to three sources familiar with the matter. One of the sources said Burgess was the likely nominee, but cautioned no decision had been made. Burgess, 74, is a Texas physician who retired from Congress in January after 22 years. During the pandemic, he described vaccines to Congress as safe and effective tools that have been proven to protect Americans from preventable, life-threatening diseases, and spoke about the need to confront vaccine hesitancy in the country. Burgess, the White House, and CDC did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The CDC director would lead the response to public health threats, including the measles outbreak in West Texas and New Mexico that has killed two people, and play a critical role in the response to the spread of bird flu. Burgess would report to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has sown doubt about the safety of vaccines for decades. Kennedy has stopped short of urging patients and parents that children be vaccinated in response to the measles outbreak, saying it is a matter of personal choice. Before being appointed, Kennedy pledged to Senator Bill Cassidy, a doctor who has expressed wariness about the secretary's anti-vaccine views, that he would protect existing vaccination programs. Cassidy, who heads the health committee that would review Burgess's nomination, did not respond to a request for comment. CDC is responsible for making vaccine recommendations for Americans, including by making the childhood vaccination schedule, and funds vaccines for children who otherwise would not have access to them. CDC currently is overseen by Susan Munares, previously Deputy Director of Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health. That was the article, White House Considering Burgess to Lead CDC. The next article is Conservative Groups Urge FCC to End Probe into 60 Minutes Harris Interview. Conservative advocacy groups on Thursday asked Federal Communications Commission to reject a news distortion complaint over CBS's 60 Minutes interview with then-Vice President Kamala Harris that aired in October 2024. Center for Individual Freedom, Americans for Tax Reform, Taxpayers Protection Alliance, and other groups urged FCC Chairman Brendan Carr to end the investigation into the unit of Paramount Global, saying an adverse ruling against CBS would constitute regulatory overreach and advance precedent that can be weaponized by future FCCs. FCC is reviewing whether the broadcast violates news distortion rules. Although the agency is prohibited from censorship or infringing First Amendment rights of media, broadcasters cannot intentionally distort the news. The groups also urged FCC to take steps to curtail the commission's ability to engage in content-based regulation and reviews. The group said there was legitimate concern about prior action aimed against conservatives, but said the better course is to eliminate rules on news distortion complaints. We understand and appreciate why many conservatives would seek to now level the playing field and subject other media organizations, such as CBS's parent company, Paramount, to the same regulatory cudgel that has long affected conservative media, the group said. Carr said in an email to Reuters he was rejecting the group's request to immediately dismiss the complaint against CBS. The FCC's review of the complaint against CBS remains active and ongoing, he said. The American Civil Liberties Union said separately there was no basis to investigate. To conduct an investigation into news distortion without a thread of evidence appears intended to harass CBS and chill those putting forth disfavored viewpoints, the group said. CBS, which is owned by Paramount Global, said earlier this month that sanctioning the company over the interview would blatantly violate the First Amendment by substituting the government's editorial judgment for that of CBS and its journalists. A complaint alleges CBS violates the FCC's rules on news distortion. The network broadcast a portion of Harris's answer on Face the Nation and a different one on 60 Minutes. CBS released the unredacted video and transcript to FCC to make it public, as did the broadcaster. President Donald Trump has sued CBS for $20 billion over the broadcast. Paramount is seeking FCC approval for an $8.4 billion merger with Skydance Media. In February, FCC reinstated complaints about the 60 Minutes interview with Harris, as well as about how Walt Disney's ABC News moderated the pre-election TV debate between then-President Joe Biden and Trump, as well as against Comcast's NBC for letting Harris appear on Saturday Night Live shortly before the election she lost to Trump. The prior FCC chair rejected those complaints. And that was the article, Conservative Groups Urge FCC to End Probe into 60 Minutes Harris Interview. That is all the time we have today for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Julia. Thank you for listening.